Welcome to the Open House Melbourne Catalyst podcast series. Open House Melbourne acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation as the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast was recorded. This podcast series explores themes or issues that act as catalysts for creative design thinking and clever design solutions. Each episode features a designer or creative in conversation with a client or field expert to unpack the topic through the lens of design and the built environment. This podcast was made possible with support from the Alastair Swain Foundation. Find out more at alastairswainfoundation.org. I'm your host, Tanya Davidge, and in this episode, we're looking at play as a catalyst for design, creativity, and engaging people with the city. Cities are not only for living and working. Cities are also places where we play. And play can be many things. It can be creative and active, or reflective and imaginative. Play is about discovery and curiosity, and it's good for the body and it's good for the soul. This catalyst conversation looks at how we play in the city and the ways in which design can foster playful connections in an urban environment. Today we're speaking with Professor Lisa Grocott from Monash University and artist Mike Hewson as we explore the ways play and a playful mindset can foster connection and creativity in the city. Lisa, you're a researcher and a professor of play. Can you tell us about what this means and a little bit about the work that you do?
Kia ora, thank you. I am a professor of play in Denmark, actually, at the design school, Kolding. And that is an honorary position that funded by the LEGO Foundation, actually. So I guess that's all about centering play. And that is in the Design for Play Lab. And then in Melbourne, I am the co-director of Wonder Lab, and my background is in co-design. So that's the sort of setup to, I think, why I'm here today.
And what does Wonder Lab do?
Our unofficial title is that we think of it as a community of researchers coming together that are interested in things that we agree don't have to be this way. And so it feels like its focus is on transformative change. But because, you know, it's within a design and art sort of faculty, it has a sort of orientation to how might creativity and different ways of working, different ways of engaging in particular, help unsettle the things that lock in the way we do things, so we might do them differently.
Perfect. That sounds really fascinating. I'm glad we're here to unpack that. And Mike, can you tell us a little bit about your background and your art practice?
Yeah, well, I actually started as a civil engineer who was I enjoyed it, but I was sort of a little unsatisfied with the contribution that I was making, and I sort of moved slowly into the arts. And as a part of my first major permanent public artwork commission, I made a playground because, you know, the council had removed one when they modified the pedestrian mall. And I was more thinking about sculpture and also like replacing what was there. And then afterwards, we sort of actually won a Playground of the Year award for this like kind of sculpture park, which was just three giant stones with a palm tree poked through with a little swing on it. And I realized that was a great format for sculpture, but also that you can really make these kind of quite complex and strange places which really hit on some of the essential parts of, you wouldn't even say it's really emerging ideology around play, but it's always been that kind of complex spaces are really stimulating and great for learning. And these sort of, you know, opportunities for unscripted and, pieces of public space can really do a lot. So I basically saw that and I was like, well, I should just keep doing this thing, and it's a great way of funding art projects. So I've sort of, you know, this hybrid artist engineer, but most of the projects that I've done recently have had, I guess, play involved, but I guess it's also just very permissive public space. And a little bit transgressive in that I'm pushing against kind of bureaucracy and kind of design, kind of what everyone assumes to be the way things should be, and kind of pushing against that and realizing, oh, there is actually a lot more we can do with public space.
I mean, it's quite interesting. I've obviously got two New Zealanders here with me.
Kia ora.
Only just realised. But also, I think, you know, even just in that little teeny unpacking of your bios, there's an interest in structural change, in transformation, and play.
and the way maybe play can be involved in that. Where does your interest in play come from? Maybe we can go to you first.
Yeah, I'll stick with what I was going to talk about. But yeah, I feel like it would be really tempting now to start going on about unscripted play in Aotearoa growing up. But the piece that I think, in terms of at least explicitly understanding my relationship to play, is I was a design educator in Parsons in New York, and I was teaching in a master's that was about transdisciplinary design. So it really was in this space of, you know, how would you work across disciplines and, you know, think differently. And my students kept going to this one-off class that they all raved about, whether they were the nerdy kids, the introverted kids, the really creative kids, but they didn't have any language for describing what would happen in this class. They'd just keep saying it's amazing. And then they'd describe something that sounded like some, in my mind, horror show of kind of improv. And it just was so deeply unsettling to me, even the idea of it. But being a curious person, I was sort of needed to understand why they were also moved by this experience. So somehow I signed up at 7:30 on a Monday night to go to this play workshop. And when we went in, it was all of my worst nightmares. We were like passing energy around the room and some zigzag kind of, you know, activity. And I was sort of rolling my eyes thinking, yeah, this is my worst nightmare. And then as the session played out, it wasn't so much that I got more comfortable, but I kept thinking all the time that everyone else was missing the point, that every activity we would do, I'd be trying to really understand how to game the activity and what we were supposed to be doing. And I was trying to second guess what I thought, you know, the goal of it was. And then there was one activity we were playing, which was sort of like a game of it, where, you know, someone was sort of tagged. And it felt so easy for me to work out how not to be it. I kept looking at all the people that were being stuck in the middle, thinking, what is wrong with these people? Like, you know, like it's not that hard. You just think strategically. And the game went on and on and on. And then the facilitator, whose name's Roger, said, you know, like, I think I annoyingly said, maybe the game only stops when everyone's been it, which I think was just a really embarrassing way of showing to the room that I hadn't been it yet. And he said, no, that's not how it works. And it played longer and longer. And then in the debrief, there was a sort of moment when everyone was sort of explaining, you know, what they thought this play experience was teaching them. And it was about empathy and, you know, all these things and strategizing and nonverbal communication, basically. And then I looked at one guy and I was like, I couldn't even make eye contact with you because you were just making like the craziest decisions. It was just like far too risky to even look at you. And the guy just looked at me incredulously and he was like, what was the risk? And in that moment, I kind of realized that I was the singular person in the room that had been kind of playing it so straight that I was only thinking of how to win when everyone else had been having fun. And that was a very illuminating moment for me, and I could talk more about what that revealed as Roger and I became collaborators. But yeah, I think that that really experiential understanding of what play could reveal to you about the way that you were in the world was transformative for me, yeah.
So you can play, but you can play not necessarily to win, which is kind of a potentially interesting
thing. Yeah, and he pointed out that if there'd been a video, I was the only person that was like constantly like observing the room and not laughing, and everyone else was just like sprinting into the middle of the room, getting caught out, laughing, you know, like in it. And I was like really not present and not joyful and not
Completely engaged.
Yes.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Mike, I think what you do is incredibly engaged and engaging. Is that something you think about when you're thinking about like your next project?
I often just think about how I can be most sort of generous and kind of, yeah, the least controlling I can possibly be, which is basically ends up making projects that are so tough and can handle disrespect that people can sort of use it in whichever way they want. And for me, that's really what I'm trying to do is, I mean, I think, you know, talk about play. It's also really just about living and sort of living in a way that has a sense of freedom and where people have a sense for themselves that they have sort of agency and ownership over how they move through space, what they do, how they make decisions. It's just a particularly important, you know, gift to give to children. I often think that if I can give an opportunity for a child to feel powerful, you know, they sort of scramble to the top of a rock or kind of climb this mini cliff face and feel a sense of individual kind of conquering their own thing. That's often what I think about, and often what that means is you're pushing against what is generally accepted as suitable things in public space. Where, you know, my parks are often called, and I'm calling them sort of parks now rather than playgrounds, because I think that often limits people's thinking. Like they're called risky playgrounds or something, and that's not a term that I came up with, but it's a term that people have put on them because I guess it has the outward appearance of something that looks quite dodgy. But I guess the intent really is to just, I mean, really it's kind of just recreating the opportunities I had at a little country school growing up, where we were just really able to really do whatever we wanted and kind of make a lot of these decisions around risk and fun ourselves. And so I'm just sort of really bringing that into an urban environment as best I see fit. And often that just involves sort of incrementally pushing against these kind of limits. And so in each project, I try and extend a little bit off the last one, or I'll prove a point in one park, and in the next one, I'll kind of build on that and sort of push a little bit more. And as these parks sort of succeed as these, you know, permanent examples of what can be done, it actually opens up a lot more for other designers, for other thinkers. It's really actually great for carers and parents as well, because, you know, when a government organisation endorses a park that, you know, appears to be risky, it sort of empowers the parent to go, oh, it is actually okay for me to allow my kids to experience or be adventurous. And it frees them up, because often a lot of the thing is, you know, carers just don't want to be irresponsible and exposed and shamed for being reckless. And, yes. You know, I think foolhardy or reckless is not an endearing quality in any sense. And so what I do when I'm planning these things is I go all the way into the safety and planning, and, you know, I get people that are on the standards committee to kind of the Australian for playground standards to review my parks. I try and get as many people in to question the projects, and then they can be really robust because they've all had that analysis and that sort of consideration, and it sort of allows it to be, you know, that's how you can push the boundaries a little bit.
Absolutely. And I think this question of risk in an urban park or an urban playground setting is really interesting. I grew up near a creek. You had to kind of almost roll down quite a rocky hill. The train line ran through parts of it nearby, and we all kind of like ran through the tunnel to see if we could, you know, not get hit by trains and stuff like that. And so, but as we move, I suppose, to more urbanized living, to places where we're living more in like slightly higher density, in apartments, like where, how do we build risk, or how do we build that ability for kids to play in that way? Into a more urbanised environment. I think that's really, really fascinating. I think, Lisa, you grew up in a similar situation where play was pretty important but also a bit more freeform.
Yeah, ours was definitely on a riverbank, you know, making huts and those sorts of things. And it is, even just the walk to school felt more playful, right, because it was, you know, it was a town that had the sort of frost, so the whether it was the way we would sort of stamp to feel our presence and sort of see it in the world on the frost, but, you know, the fake smoking and all those sorts of things with the air, it was like, you know, there was just a really different way of being, you know, in terms of the free range, the fact that we even walked to school, right, whereas my children were getting on a subway and, you know, like navigating a completely urban environment even for their commute to school.
Yeah, yeah, very different, very different. And I think that relationship of play and place is quite interesting. I mean, the places you make, Mike, are really unique and very different from that structured kind of we can just buy playground equipment in. I'm thinking particularly, I suppose, of the Rocks on Wheels playground down in South Bank. That's one, I suppose, I've had actual experience of. I didn't actually take my kids down there. I went down there and swung on the swings and climbed the bits and pieces. And I think that's maybe a really lovely thing about when you say you don't call them playgrounds anymore, you call them parks. Is there something, is that kind of a conscious thing around
broadening the accessibility or the, you know, that invitation for everybody to use them, whether they're kids or not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's just getting closer to the kind of that piazza idea of public space being an intergenerational thing that does a lot for a lot of different people, and it's not scripted in its use. I also kind of maybe trying to avoid the word play now because it's just become so innocuous and, you know, it's corporatized and people just sort of throw it around to the point where it's really lost, it can sort of have lost its meaning. But yeah, when I'm thinking about parks, I'm thinking about, you know, all ages, designing, you know, spaces for older people who say don't have children to not feel alienated by the design of a piece of infrastructure or area which is, you know, largely intended for children. I mean, I think the same thing goes for teenagers. And I think intergenerational mixing is really important for a sort of a cohesive and connected society. And if we're designing spaces that alienate certain age groups or sectors, that's not to say you don't think about, you know, safety and design for various aspects. I just believe you can do it all. And I don't think this sort of siloed approach to design really works, and it's not really connecting us. And so, yeah, I sort of dive into the detail, trying to think about all the interconnected, you know, arguably like kind of intersectional aspects of these things, and then also try and broaden. So you sort of, you go for the, you know, you go into the nitty gritty of this safety thing. I've often talked about the sort of the dullness matrix as an antidote to the risk matrix, where you've also got to question if you're really designing places that have no surprise, no interest and no ingenuity, you're not tapping into this very important part of life that we seek, which is adventure, things that are novel, things that, you know, challenge us cognitively. And the sort of things that develop those qualities have a competing set of objectives to, say, the risk matrix assessment approach to responsible decision making. So I think you have to do both, but they fight each other. And if you don't have this other questioning thing around freedom and surprise, then, you know, I think it's what has gotten us to this point where we think everything is about safety. And just because you say things, you know, like, doesn't mean you can't sort of do both. And each society needs to kind of wrestle with what that looks like for them. You know, there's no right or wrong exactly. I mean, if you go to a lot of different countries around the world, you know, there's no barriers next to a canal. You know, there's not handrails in the same locations. You know, work health and safety kind of paradigms are quite different. And none of them are necessarily right or wrong. Some of them are like really unhinged, but there is a benefit to all of that. And we have to wrestle over what's the right shape for us and constantly question it.
Mm, absolutely. I mean, I think often, you know, this is Open House Melbourne is kind of more design and built environment focused. And often when we think about play from a design perspective, you know, we do think about its physical or functional manifestations. We think about playgrounds, parks, you know, childcare centres, leisure recreational facilities, those kind of things. But I think some of those things and the qualities that you're describing that we need to see in the city and we need to experience show us that play is much more than its physical manifestation. And Lisa, you don't really work in that physical design space at all. So what is the role of play in what you do? And do you engage with those same kind of themes and issues that Mike is interested in?
Yeah, I think for me it's really interesting listening to Mike talk about it, because in the very beginning you know describe that you're trying to make these unscripted spaces or spaces that have different sort of permissions attached to them, which I could completely align to the way that we're making decisions. But I think what I've really taken away from listening to Mike talk about it is the way that you described as someone, you know, physically scaled, you know, a space, and that afforded for them, you know, a different kind of feeling of conquering something. I think that if I think of watching my children, they had the kit kind of version. So, you know, every Brooklyn neighborhood would have, you know, the bad
local kit playground, but there were also beautifully designed, you know, parks that were very open-ended in the way that they were constructed. And it was really clear that the ones that, you know, they would say things like, you can't climb this unless you're 12, but my four-year-old would want to climb it. And in a New Zealand way, we'd be like, of course you can, but all the other parents wouldn't be letting their kids climb it. And then you'd be in these other design spaces where, listening to Mike talk about it, I thought it's almost like each space would have been designed around a different emotional affordance of play, right? You know, so there was the Tower Mountain kind of place where you're going up really tall slides and it's all about, you know, the slide's scary because it's in the dark and this one's the tallest and this one's the fastest. You know, so there's a kind of courage attached to that. Then there would be these sort of swing valley, which was, you know, obviously designed for just how high you could swing and the kind of liberatory feeling of that. And then there'd be the sand castle space where you'd be co-creating with parents and making things. And that idea that each one of those little, you know, landscapes within this larger park was designed to bring out a different sort of emotional quality through the kind of physical experience. I think it's just a really clear reminder that there's, you know, that there's a, like the Mike described it, as sort of living instead of not just playing, but living. But, you know, that those sort of ways of living and being in the world that are really important, but the spaces afford them. So for me, the fact that I might not be designing physical sort of permanent spaces, but I'm sort of trying to design, you know, encounters and experiences that would bring out those same qualities because they seem essential to how we might learn to live better.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit maybe about the Tomorrow Party project and how, so to give us a bit of an example of how that intangible, the intangible qualities of play might play out. Yeah, when you co-design something.
So the Tomorrow Party is an activity that, you know, takes a couple of hours in the meeting people where they're at, you know, making it something that anyone could kind of step into. It's essentially just saying, yeah, this is not a workshop. You don't need any foresight skills or whatever to do this. It's a party. And we all know how to sort of show up at a party. And it's been designed in these sort of different, you know, acts that we take people through where you're sort of, if you think of, I don't know, teaching people the rules of a game or when you first encounter a play space, how you might be working out what are the permissions of the space. You know, the first part is getting people just comfortable with the idea that you're going to ask them to time travel. And then in the middle of the party, you effectively, you know, just talk in pairs in multiple rounds. But if I was talking to you, you know, we've all time traveled to a particular world that we outline in the framing of the party. And you're speaking as if you were living in that world. So you're not sort of detached from it in a, I don't know, like a utopian workshop of like, oh, the, you know, community now looks like this. You're just living in it. So if I'm asking you, what does it feel like to be in this world? You're just describing to me, not just your everyday in a descriptive way, but how it feels. How does this feel different to the world I was living in before? And so I would say that the biggest ask of that in a playful way is that people find it really hard to be imaginative, right? Like they keep wanting to tell you what they've already know, or they want to tell you their strategic plan, or they want to, and so to just ask them to speak to feelings or activities they haven't really done, it's that sort of imaginative literacy that people mm-hmm. find the hardest and value the most. Yeah.
And when you do the Tomorrow Party, is it like what is it? What is it for? Like, what are the is it around policy making? Like, who does these workshops? And like, is there a question that they're trying to answer by projecting themselves into the near future?
Yeah. So the one that we've got coming up is we are doing one at the American Museum of Natural History, which is the Knights at the Museum in New York. And it's for New York Climate Week. And the project was funded by Wellcome and they're bringing us back to do this project. And their whole policy agenda, the influencing kind of work that policy Wellcome seeks to do is around making sure that health is centered in climate change and that we realize, you know, that planetary health and humans' health are intrinsically connected. And so that particular Tomorrow Party is bringing together people that are in the sort of cultural sector, policy-making sector, and the kind of climate science people. And by having sort of 45 leaders in those fields all in one room together and time traveling, you know, to 5 years out from now, the idea is, you know, how might they How might we imagine, we call them tomorrow stories, how might we imagine tomorrow stories that would help shape the kind of policy that they think the UNFCCC needs to be doing, or how to take these ideas to future COPs, et cetera, so that we can kind of pollinate people's, you know, imagination for kind of policy change and adaptive approaches to climate change, et cetera. So it's creating a space for people co-creating, yeah, different social imaginaries to sort of change the story of how we might
and
do
it probably
this work together.
Takes you out of your everyday structure and puts you into a more aspirational, I suppose, or a kind of creative mind frame.
Yeah, excellent question. Though when we did the research part of the Tomorrow Party, like went back and asked people, it was the people that told us that it was imaginative literacy that was the most important thing they were getting out of it. But the bit that they said most happened for them when they left was that they couldn't remember the last time they found that level of hope. So it was actually, whether it was hope for the fact that there was a room full of people that cared, whether it was hope for how their life might shift, whether it was hope for the planet, whether it was hope for, you know, the work their organization was doing, it just sort of seeded, there was something, yeah, it was really in that capacity to feel, you know, kind of optimistic that, to go back to Mike's language before, that, you know, the scripts that in a way hold us back, something about shifting those scripts and the possibilities that that opens up was, I think, the most creative.
That's really quite beautiful, actually, isn't it? Mike, in terms of, I suppose, imagination, there's two levels. What your parks do, or what your work does, I think, is really inspire kids, or not only kids, my imagination as well, I've got to say. But what, in terms of your own imagination and your own creative practice, like what are the kind of things that drive you?
Well, I'm just sort of following my curiosities, really, and kind of trying to nurture what they are, and sort of, I mean, I think that's the best thing you can also do for a child, for example, as a carer or a parent, is to kind of, you know, really just be interested in what they're interested in, and kind of allow that to be unpacked. And I guess as a designer and as an artist, you sort of, you know, you're really trying to do things that are unique or new, and, you know, ideally, like, contribute to the world in some way. And so I guess, you know, for me at this point, I'm really trying to just follow what my interests are and invest in as much in those types of things. I ended up doing, you know, structural civil engineering and working in marine construction in my early 20s. And I did really enjoy that because it was sort of this very structured, lens for understanding the world. But then when I actually got into, you know, went from university into work in marine construction, so many things go wrong, and it's just such a wild environment that you sort of have to really have these plans that are quite broad spectrum in their ability to deal with sort of unforeseen scenarios. And so I've sort of just allowed that to transition into my art making. And I guess a lot of people, when I did the first playground, were like, oh yeah, that's a cool sculpture. But when I proposed to do the next one, they were like, wait, you're an artist. You shouldn't be doing playgrounds. That's low. You know, you're like, they didn't say you're better than that. Well, they effectively said you're better than that. But I had to just trust myself and my intuition, which was like, no, I think there's something really in this and I'm going to do it. So so the next project I did in St. Peter's, with this kind of fence graveyard that was sort of rebuilding the front fences of homes that the government had taken from people in that area in the West for sort of highway expansion. And I was like, oh, I want to rebuild the front fences as these kind of like ghost markers of the community that had been, you know, morphed over the last 30 years. But it took a lot of kind of, I don't know, when a mentor or someone important to you sort of says, oh, I don't know about that, but you have to, you know, learn to like trust yourself that there is something in that. I think that's been what I'm trying to continue on with. And I think that's really a great way of sort of breaking barriers. And you know, sometimes you get it wrong and, you know, what you do really isn't that interesting. But I feel like that's a really great quality to kind of even just to live out and have other people watch what you're doing and have, you know, people have seen me over the last 10 years start and do something and kind of go, where's he going with this one? And kind of, but then it sort of eventually finds its place when you've done enough of it, and it sort of catalyzes and puts together this bigger picture. People have like really, I mean, I think the South Bank project really galvanized for people a lot of the ideas. You know, it was like it's sort of like everything came home to, you know, sort of, yeah, people could see it. And it's been nice because that's now really put it on another trajectory of some quite interesting projects.
And you can really see, I think, your engineering background coming through in that, because it kind of plays with the kind of, you know, what we think gravity does to things and how things need to stand up and be held up, which is really quite clever. And I think definitely piqued my curiosity. I think I may have lay on the ground and looked under some of the things to just kind of work out how they were standing up. And it was really fascinating. But I just wanted to go back a little bit. I thought it was quite interesting. I think it's quite interesting that we devalue play or a playful mindset because we associate it with children. You can see the value in play in very, very, in very different types of work, in your work, Mike, and in your work, Lisa. And it's not about associating play with children in any way, shape, or form. It's actually about kind of thinking about what the value of play is in a much broader context, and how we can value that a little better. So is there something maybe we should discuss a little bit about, like, is it important for adults to play and to think about play in a different way as well?
Yeah, we just have another word for it, right? Like, you know, a party, you know, that's the next version of, or sort of play for adults, right? That's the kind of thing that people look forward to, whether it's like going out for dinner and having a drink or going dancing or like some adventure sport. We just have another word for it, but it, you know, and often all of those pursuits have a component of even if it's just reading a book, I guess there's some sort of cognitive stimulation, there's some kind of extension, and pushing sort of outside of your comfort zone. So I think it's just kind of, I mean, what I'm doing is trying to observe what those things are that we do as adults that are kind of adventurous and kind of, you know, can I jump on board with what's already happening or what's already an impulse or an urge or a kind of, yeah, a curiosity.
I mean, for me, my answer would be quite different. I would say it's a resounding yes that we need adults to find places for play. I suppose I can relate to Mike's point that we find outlets for it, but I suppose that they feel like quite impoverished versions of what play could be, right? Like I think that we do at some point, you know, we admire play in children. We see the wonder of it, the awe, the curiosity, the, you know, the kind of opening up that comes with that being in a sort of experimental, you know, somewhat unscripted space. And then the example of things like the dinner party or dancing or, you know, they're still quite scripted environments. So to me, they have a, you know, they're not work and they might have an openness and a kind of creative sense to them, but I wonder what it looks like, you know, to create spaces that, or to not act like we age out of play, I guess is the other way of thinking about it. Because, you know, what does happen is that you obviously school environment, lots of environments, but, you know, you start saying to children, stop playing around, you know, sit still, be quiet, you know, like, you know, you start to question when people are using, yeah, like you might value a strategic plan over a kind of speculative vision or, you know, like, or we keep tying things back to, well, what would be the performance indicators or what would, you know, so there's just a whole way of framing the world that just gets, I don't know, straighter and straighter. And I think that any way that we can kind of inflect, you know, into the way that we do what we do, which is what I hear Mike saying when he says he's using curiosity to make the next decision, right? Whereas if you were really thinking in some artist strategic plan of, you know, I want this gallery, you know, next, and then I want this, and then I, you know, then you, it wouldn't have opened up the kind of spaces. So that sort of idea of letting things like curiosity and, you know, wonder guide more of our decision-making, I think that's I think we'd be in a really different place. Like I believe it would be transformative if we allowed play to
sit within our worlds in a different way as adults.
Yes, I did a very structured literature review on play for my PhD, hilarious, and Lee, and how it played out in architecture. So in kind of books and academic research on architecture, and invariably almost everything was about the form and the function. So it was about playgrounds and, as I mentioned before, recreational facilities. And I did think that there was this huge gap. There was this incredible, because play and, like, you know, design is meant to be creative, right? And for me, part of creativity is actually about playing with, you know, essentially playing with different things and thinking about things, I suppose, in that way. And yet there was almost no research. There was no, almost no literature in that kind of architectural field around that aspect of play, which I thought was fascinating. And you use kind of unscripted play to teach your students, don't you, Lisa? So what does that do for them? Like, do you think, how does it help?
Yeah, so the guy whose workshop, Roger, that I, you know, somewhat tentatively went to, I ended up working with him years later, where we were running a studio together that was on the idea of transforming mindsets. So it was essentially that if the, you know, as designers, the graduates were going to go out into the world and be trying to help people shift their practices, whether that was as teachers or architects or whatever that might be, and that they also had to think of what it meant to shift something themselves. So it was, you know, trying to build that idea that, you know, you didn't want to come in a judgy, you know, why can't you just do this way now, and like realize how hard it is to change the way that we show up. And so that it was a 6-hour design studio, and we spent 2 hours just doing unscripted play. And Roger's work's always nonverbal, so it's all just kind of versions of, yeah, physical kind of games. And it was just kind of fascinating to sort of see. So the students at the end of the semester, their complaint was, you know, their biggest frustration was, you know, we lost a third of our studio time to not working on our project. and that felt really hard to do things in 4 hours. And it was a collaborative project. And the most surprising thing was that they'd done the best work they'd ever done. And they said that the way they collaborated in the 4 hours was so completely different to the way they sort of delegated normally, and the way that they saw each other's whole selves. So they had in the play space, they would realize, right, that, oh, I'm quite controlling in this space, or I am really timid and I hold back, or I'm trying to think 3 steps ahead and I can't just be present. Or, you know, they became very self-aware of the way they played, and that became something that they were allowed to talk about in a collaboration, right? So I could recognize, oh, you are so good at this because you are like really good at knowing where everyone is in the room. So you should be the person at the event that's managing that. And then, you know, this person, you're like so good at, or they would work on each other's weaknesses. So it became this like really different way of collaborating that elevated their work so differently and made them really proud of the work they'd done.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
And I suppose an understanding that we work in different ways. That's quite interesting, Mike, your actual process for kind of developing the projects. I think we were on a bit of a Zoom call earlier or last week, and you showed us around your studio and just the kind of, I suppose, inspiration for that physical form of that comes from the physical form of making and thinking about the materiality of things was quite interesting. How do you work? What is your process?
Yeah, well, like kind of back to the earlier discussion around kind of, you know, play. And I think a thing to note is often that it is not impulsive, but it just occurs naturally out of curiosity. But it also doesn't really have a clear purpose. And I think that's probably one of the big barriers to why adults don't sort of want to engage with it, because we're always talking about outcomes, KPIs, you know, what's the purpose of things. But when we do end up just sort of doing something that ends up being fun, it often doesn't have a clear purpose. But what obviously you guys, as play researchers, there are huge benefits. They're just less tangible. And the same sort of, I create the same kind of process or a sort of environment in my studio to kind of not really have a purpose for the outcome, which is really challenging for kind of council people or anyone sort of commissioning a project where I force them into this uncomfortable situation where I just say, well, I'm just kind of sitting with this thing to let it effectively speak to me, which sounds pretty woo-woo. But what that really is doing is it's allowing an environment for me to like not be under pressure to understand something, and for me to just kind of, let it sort of bubble up. And it's that dedication that I've now learned. It's taken me a while, where I'm very comfortable with uncertainty and not knowing where something's going. And I just allow it, just, you know, my subconscious will just be sort of observing and kind of playing around. And then out of that thing, I'll find something that I want to pursue. And, you know, that's why I have a huge amount of sort of arguably junk lying around. But it's just these physical materials that you need to spend some time with before you can really push them to their limits or try and see them in a new light. And I think it's been something that's taken me a long time to get to, but it's now much easier for me to make because it's just very intuitive for me.
And it's about making space for that, I suppose, level of creativity and imagination in our lives. Maybe that's something that we can all learn from this, is like that we just need to make space for that level of thinking or play or whatever you want to call it. It's actually quite beautiful.
I guess it's really about time as well. Like it's time, you know, I guess they're related, even probably, yeah, from a physics perspective. But, you know, you need to allow yourself that time. And again, play kind of, you know, when you fall into that state of playing or whatever the definition is, you know, time often just does disappear. You're not on the clock. And, you know, like kids, when they're kind of really playing, they're just lost in their own little thing. And having that time, and, you know, as adults, we struggle to kind of, you know, we have everything down to us, you know, these time slots, sort of allowing yourself time, you know, and ideally, you know, in these kind of parks that I'm designing, they're so strange. And I often try and do that intentionally because, and try and surprise people because they end up sort of dropping into that state of like curiosity and discovery where they do kind of forget where they are a little bit. Like even in South Bank with that bluestone rubber that I made to mimic the bluestone paving. I mean, a lot of people sort of are approaching the project with this kind of like, what the hell's going on here? And then they step onto the rubber and they let out like a little squeal, kind of like, and then they're really confused about what's going on because they thought they're standing on stone. And it's those kind of states that really help bring you into that, you know, that kind of curiosity, playful kind of mood.
Absolutely. I think probably from my research, the two most interesting things that I found that maybe related to play and the urban environment, public space and the public realm was, I suppose, the Situationist International, who believe that social change and transformation could be delivered through playful experiential urban intervention. So like that's why I think that Rocks on Wheels playground is absolutely fascinating to me. And it does, it really, like, as that story you just told really says, that you kind of, you can come across it without even understanding where you are, and immediately you're centered like in that moment and you're present in the city and you're like, oh, that's fantastic. It's so interesting. And I think that for me, I think play is really interesting because of that ability to transform people's experience, whether it's in that moment or it's over time.
Yeah, well, I guess I'll just briefly, one of the things that I think is really important and we need to be talking about when we're thinking about public spaces, it's the process to deliver these projects that also need to be inventive, because the way like local governments set up the procurement of these projects, the kind of, oh yeah, you get a landscape architect and oh yeah, they get another consultant and they put together a fee proposal and then blah, blah, blah. And then, oh yeah, the council will review it. And then, oh, they don't like cost too much money or, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then next thing you know, you've had so many kind of bumps in the road and structured bumps in the road where it has to be in the tender set drawings and is it in the standards. That whole process, I think, really doesn't set designers or builders up for success. And I think one of the things that's different about a lot of the projects I've worked on is I've demanded that we have inventive procurement mechanisms. And I challenge anyone to point out a truly interesting project and not trace it back to some sort of inventive procurement process where people often have to have trust and sort of a bit of, you know, you're sort of tied together in a way, and you've got risk. Both of you have got risk where you could kind of, you know, the other person is really exposed. And that has really yielded these like quite interesting outcomes. And so our current systems don't really acknowledge that. And I guess to put it back to my kind of dichotomy of things in tension, I mean, sure, you need like probity, fair process, but you also sort of need this other thing when you sort of have these interpersonal bonds where you're both exposed, sort of, you know, the working with your friends and family or your sort of work crush, where there's these kind of, you know, these processes are real. They operate in everyday life, and we sort of need to start acknowledging them at a kind of, I don't know, a governmental level to kind of get these more interesting outcomes.
I think that's fantastic. It feels like, Lisa, you need to work on local government level to change the way they think and change what the processes are and enable Mike's outcomes to be delivered in many, many more places, because I think it's really, really just wonderful. And I think the agency that it affords people, not only through the process or not, and the kids at the other end, is a really incredible outcome of some of these processes as well. I wonder maybe just to close this off, because we're getting close to time. I think that idea of agency, maybe that comes to back from Mike's comment about kids kind of climbing to the top and conquering it, but there's agency at different levels in projects like this and I suppose in co-design processes like this. Is there something about agency and kind of taking hold of your space or public space and really having a say in it you think is important?
Yeah, it's interesting because I want to try to tie together the idea of agency and Mike talking about the uncertainty, because to me it feels like if we can acknowledge that part of what's not working in the world right now is a kind of sense of detachment from, you know, like whether it's the KPIs, whether it's the procurement process is like explicit and laid out. It's like everything sort of almost works against the kind of relational piece that Mike is saying is important, right, to get that creative work done. But, you know, if we were thinking of it, you know, culturally at the level of, you know, an epidemic of loneliness or, you know, like what it means trying to build communities when we've got, you know, people living in these different high density environments. It just, to me, there is something about, if I thought of play as a catalyst for navigating uncertainty, then it feels like it's an invitation, like Mike was using, to be like, you know, if we want to design a space like this, we actually have to work together differently. You know, if we want to, in a co-design space, if we want to work differently with community, we need to design experiences that don't feel extractive, that feel relational, that people walk away with hope, not feeling like, oh, I shared my story with you and now you're going to go away and do nothing with it. Like, you know, it just, there's something about, I don't know, I'm trying to, you know, it's a long bow, but there's something about recognizing that we need such different ways of working. And I do think that navigating uncertainty is kind of such an essential part of that, because it invites risk, but with that, a deeper kind of relational, you know, possibilities. But it's that relational bit that I think gets anchored in the way you're saying, that there's a sense of agency in that, because I can show up in this playground and play the way that I want, or I can show up as an adult in this playground and be playing alongside my child, or as teenagers, we can kind of turn up and turn this into a really different sort of space. You know, there's something inherently agential about places and processes and procurement practices, you know, just being less scripted.
Yeah. In some ways, you know, our structures currently are built to distance us from the parts, and if we work differently, we can actually connect in different ways. There's something about trust, I think, as well, when you're talking about working collaboratively on uncertainty and risk. Trust, is trust important in your work, Mike?
Yeah. I mean, I guess a lot of people trust me too that this kind of thing that looks like it's about to fall off isn't going to fall off.
That's where the engineering background helps, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I certainly think, and you know, all of the, I guess, working relationships, if there's not a kind of sense of trust there early on, and often I actually do try and sabotage the kind of projects quite early on just to test whether the leadership and the power structures are really engaged with what I'm trying to do, because I mean, I have my vision about what I'm trying to do and I'll fight for it, and it'll be a very unpleasant thing working for me if you're not there for it. And I don't take it personally, because everyone has their own thing that they're trying to do. But if people are really there for the project, then it's a really great thing both ways, that we really enjoy working together because we are trying to do this thing and we do trust each other and we are both exposed in a way. And it provides that opportunity for sort of a rich working environment. And when you don't have that, or you don't have that kind of, when you aren't okay with a level of uncertainty, you're uncomfortable with it, or it's inappropriate, it's poorly timed, it's not a good recipe for a successful project. I've just learned to kind of steer towards the ones that are kind of well aligned, and it's really just, yeah, it's about finding alignment, and yeah, trust comes out of that.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to seeing your next project. Definitely. I'm really excited. And I think I'm also looking forward to keeping in touch with Lisa about the work that she's doing. There's a lot of kind of alignments in both of your practices, and I find them both fascinating. And I think if we think about it holistically as a process, you know, it's how we get better processes and how we can create better outcomes as well. But we're at the end of our time today, and I'd just like to thank you both so much for spending time chatting with me and with Open House. I feel like we could go on forever and ever, but you both, I think you've got a party to deliver, Mike.
Yeah, got a party, yeah. Yeah, a play event for adults.
Excellent.
And kids, really, and critters, you know, everyone's invited.
Fantastic. Well, we'll let you get on with that. And thank you both so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for hanging with us.
Thank you for listening to the Open House Melbourne Catalyst podcast. Open House Melbourne delivers Australia's largest architecture and built environment festival and year-round programming that connects people to place and builds public understanding of good design, inspiring people to explore, celebrate, and care for their cities, suburbs, and regions. Open House Melbourne's Catalyst podcast series was made possible with support from the Alastair Swain Foundation. Find out more at alastairswainfoundation.org. This series is recorded at The Push in Collingwood Yard, a youth music organisation and charity with the purpose of giving every young person the opportunity to participate and thrive in Australian music. Find out more about The Push at thepush.com.au.